behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. We are joined today with our super producer and colleague in arms, Matt Madman Frederick. He takes that nickname from another show.
The Madman.
The Madman.
Really? The Madman? Dare I ask, or should we just let it go at that?
I believe it is his story to tell.
Oh, I see. I understand.
Which is odd, because I made it up just now.
All right. All right. Well, today we are going to kind of wade into some waters that Car Stuff normally doesn't wade into, Ben.
Nice.
And we're going to talk about boats today, and a specific type of boat, and a really interesting bit of history, as you might expect. I mean, we seem to find kind of the unusual angles to all this stuff, and we have found a really interesting one here, and we're definitely going to talk about it today. We've touched on boats in the past. You know, we've talked about offshore racing in the past. We talked about yacht racing, crano planes,
traveling the world by cargo ship.
Yeah, exactly. We've touched on boat racing in the past and boats, but we've never done a sailing episode. There's probably a good reason behind that because neither one of us are sailors, but, we are going to talk about, something called the Danbury boat races today. And before we get to that though, I would like to read a little bit of listener mail if that's okay.
Yeah, please do.
All right. We don't normally do this either. This is not on the same subject, but I felt like it was a good time to do it. So this comes from Glenn Beck. And Glenn is just returning from the Big Sky Rally and, the 2016 rally where he's out west. And we talked about that on this show as well. And, oh, by the way, they raised more than they had hoped for in the, for Camp Sunshine. They ended up raising $118,781 to date for that cause. So, an excellent, excellent showing there by everybody who donated to that cause. Mm-hmm. And, he sent along this, this note that says, the subject was a couple of good stories. And of course, I'm interested in that always, but this is really interesting. He says, a fellow rally participant, his name is Mike, arranged for several of us Mustang drivers to join him and a friend named Rich Jr. for a breakfast after our start from Kellogg, Idaho. Now, Rich Jr. brought along his father, who is, of course, Rich Sr., and he shared a couple of very interesting stories with him at the breakfast there. He said he was retired. He's retired now, but he worked at Ford in the department that built their prototype cars.
No way.
You know, back in the day. So this is a long time ago, and I'll tell you how long ago in just a moment. The first story is, these are both very short. In 1963, Rich and his team were busy building the first Mustang. And we're not talking about the mid-engine Mustang 1, but the very first of the 1964 body cars. They had just finished putting in a 14-hour day to get the car finished. And when they were finished, somebody suggested that they go out for pizza and a few beers. Another one said, well, who's driving? And they all simultaneously turned and looked at the Mustang and decided that was the car they were going to take out for the pizza and beers. I can't believe they did that. I mean, first of all, taking a prototype car out, you know, out in the town, I guess, but they did. He says that at the pizza shop, a crowd gathered around the car and a picture even appeared in the local newspaper. He said that they took a lot of heat over that one the next day at work because, or soon after, whenever the picture appeared. It's like the early days of the spy photography, you know, like without the camouflage.
Oh, wow.
Boy, I'll have to look that up. I'm going to see if I can find that
photo. Yeah, it's got to be out there somewhere.
Some microfiche somewhere in some, in some newspaper. The second story is, of course, we know Lee Iacocca came up with the minivan idea while he was still at Ford, and he and Rich... Iacocca, along with Rich and his team, built a prototype of the minivan while they were at Ford. Well, Henry Ford II saw it and hated the idea. And he and Iacocca were already on the outs already. And this was the final straw. So Henry II fired Iacocca. Iacocca left, but he took the minivan blueprints and the prototype itself with him to Chrysler, and the rest is history. Hmm. That's how Chrysler came to have their first minivan is because of Lee Iacocca, who was working at Ford.
Oh. Wow.
Man. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just two of the tales here from this Rich Sr.
Yeah.
Over breakfast with Glenn and the guys from the rally.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, very cool. So it's, you know, right from a guy who was actually there. I love stories like that. You know, when you're talking to old timers about, you know, what they were up to during their working days, you find some interesting things. They come across some interesting characters along the way.
First-hand witnesses to history in the making, you know?
Yep. So thanks, Glenn, for sending that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, always great to hear from you, Glenn. And, of course, longtime listeners, you are probably familiar with Glenn. Now we're moving to something a little bit different, as you said earlier, Scott, and I really appreciated your wade into new waters.
Oh, thank line. You.
That was pretty cool.
I usually leave that stuff up to you, but today I felt like I had a solid one.
You felt the calling,
yeah,
right?
I did.
So we're going to start our story in the U.S., in the northeastern part, in New England, mm-hmm. in a place called Danbury, specifically Danbury, Connecticut.
Yeah, western Connecticut at the former Danbury State Fairgrounds.
Right, yeah.
We have to say former because as of, 1981, I believe, mm-hmm. they don't hold that fair there any longer. It's moved somewhere else.
Right, yeah. So the Danbury Fair was an annual exhibition that started in 1821. So there's a lot of history behind this.
Yeah, it was an agricultural fair at that time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just so. And they didn't really have a schedule that they consistently stuck to for the first couple decades. It wasn't until 1869 that they actually got their schedule of 10 days every October once a year.
Yeah, and that was because a couple of hat manufacturers mm-hmm. by the name of Rundle and White stepped in and decided that they were going to make the Danbury Fair part of the Farmers and Manufacturers Society. And that's it just grew the fair exponentially because the fair took up 100 acres of what they would hope would be called the Danbury Pleasure Park, mm-hmm. Which just I think it later on it just became known as the Great Danbury State Fair.
Right, yeah, the biggest, best show in town. Admission was 25 cents for adults, 15 cents for the kiddos. You would go here, and if you've seen a state fair, then you probably have a pretty good idea approximately of what this was like. You would see a lot of local produce, right?
Yeah.
Fruits, probably some locally made like wines or ciders, beverages. Then they would also be selling hats, leather goods.
Yeah, there's like the livestock. There's, people trying to grow the largest tomatoes and watermelons and pumpkins and things like that. And, you know, all the stuff that goes along with the state fair, plus the midway.
Right.
Plus, and this is my favorite part about fairs, they have things like demolition derbies. Mm-hmm. They have, the auto thrill shows. Mm-hmm. They have motorcycle stunt shows. One thing that they had here was car racing. Well, initially they had horse racing.
Right.
Then they moved on to midget car racing, stock car races on a small dirt track that they had on the fairgrounds, like a quarter mile track.
Right, around 1932.
Yeah, 1932. And so they've been doing that for a while. And then right around, I think it was like in the 1940s when the guy that, we'll get to the guy that runs the place in just a moment.
Sure.
But right around 1940 is when it switched hands, when there became an owner of the fair, one single person.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about him later, but moving past that, about 10 years after this guy took over, in 1950, something very unusual happened at the Danbury Fairgrounds, and something that only existed for 1 year. They only ran for one season.
Right. We're putting on our mist in history caps today, my friends, because let's see, how would they have pitched this, do you think, Scott? If we could what if a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
How would you tell the decision makers at the fair, because now there's one owner, right?
Yeah.
But there were easily around 1,000 or more people who worked on this thing.
Yeah, well, there's 1,000 employees by what year was it?
1895?
Like, yeah, so it's a huge fair. It's probably grown, even bigger than that.
Leaps
at that
bounds,
point. Maybe
yeah.
Let's say like 1,200 or something like that.
Sure.
So how do you get they're hoping to get 100,000 visitors or, even more than that to come through this place. Well, I don't know, Ben. I mean, what do you do? I guess you'd put posters all over town,
sure.
Proclaiming what you're about to do because it's sort of, I'd say it's revolutionary, really. I mean, we see versions of this now in the modern times. I mean, we see, mm-hmm. Like with jet boat racing where they put those giant V8 engines into small boats and mm-hmm. they flood, low dugout trenches in a field somewhere. That's sort of like this, but what do you do? And you tell them that you're going to create the nation's first aquaway.
Right. You heard it correctly, folks. The nation's first aquaway, meaning a marine racetrack.
Yeah. So on the grounds where there was formerly the dirt track,
right.
the car racing track,
which
is an oval,
the
like a quarter mile oval track. they decided they were going to flood that. So they called it the former horse racing mm-hmm. track. They were going to flood that. So they had to build walls on the edges. You know, I think it looked like tile walls to me mm-hmm. That they built. And they were going to somehow keep water in this track area for deep enough for boat races. They were going to run, you know, like these little hydroplane-type boat races.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing undertaking, really, when you think about it. Just to think about the logistics of doing something like this. And they're going to keep that for at least one season. I think they had plans to go farther than that, but
right.
We'll find out what happened later.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
This was early in 1950. So May 20th of 1950, it was a Saturday. That was the very first, you know, the opening night of these speedboat races at the Danbury Fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you said, the track's about a fourth of a mile long, oval, 30 feet wide, 3 feet deep.
Yeah, 3 feet deep. So they're going to keep 3 feet of water on a dirt racetrack. Now that's, I mean, I'm sure they're continually adding water to this thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, not only evaporation, but also, you know, just water soaking in, you know, seeping in. They did this for a full season, Ben. They did this every Saturday for a full season. So it's a really fascinating thing. And not only did they do this, they decided that they were going to build their own type of boat to race in these races because it's an unusual course. It's very small,
right.
Very, very narrow, as you can imagine.
Most boats aren't going to be able to fit in that.
Yeah. What do we say? It was 30 feet wide.
Yeah. 30 feet wide.
So a quarter mile around, 30 feet wide, 3 feet deep. The depth really doesn't matter because these boats run so shallow.
Right.
But you can imagine what we're talking about, or maybe you can't. I don't know. They're very small boats. They're about 10 feet, 5 inches in length. And the beam, which is the widest part of the boat, is about 55 inches. So mm-hmm. you get two or three of these side by side on the course, and that's all the width you've got, really. There's not a lot of elbow room, I guess, in this case.
Right. Yeah. These are tiny one person outfits.
Yeah. And they were built by the fair's, carpenter, the master mm-hmm. carpenter at the fair, and his name was Kohler. I forget his first name.
Harold Kohler.
Harold Kohler. That's the guy. And, so the owner of the fair commissioned him to design and build these boats, and he did. I think he probably had others that helped him. I don't think he built every single one of them.
No, it's too many boats.
Yeah. We didn't really discuss how many there are either yet.
Yeah.
There's some speculation that there were as many as 29, mm-hmm. but as few as 21. So, you can see there's going to be some number discrepancies here as we talk about this, and we'll just be upfront about this that, you know, from different sources you hear different things.
Sure.
And the speculation is that there were between 21 and 29. Most of them were wooden hull boats.
However.
Yeah, there were two that were fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the two fiberglass boats still exists. There's only a few still around, and that's why we're talking about them today, because they had a reunion recently.
Mm-hmm.
By recently, I mean 2010. And I just kind of stumbled across these news items and pulled together some info from here and there and found out about this thing. But in 2010, three of them came together on one lake to just kind of get together and race again against each other for the first time in 60 years that they've been together.
Right. And we need to emphasize that part, Scott. They were still in racing condition. They had been kept up. This is boat 24, 28, and 38, right?
Yes. And there's another one that is supposedly seaworthy that is in Wisconsin somewhere. And we'll get to where these all dispersed later. But there's one more that didn't make it to this event that we're talking about in Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
The lake on Massachusetts. And they said the only other reunion that these boats have had was back in the 1980s. And that's significant because, well, I guess maybe not as significant as the 2010 event. Because in the 1980s, that was just after they were kind of rediscovered, right?
Right.
Because we said that it was only one season,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like there's so many, we're skipping over so much here, but there was only one season, so the 1950 season, and after that, they were just put into dry storage. They were put mm-hmm. away in some warehouse on the fairgrounds, you know, in a shed somewhere, a big building. But the amazing part is that the owner of the fair, and of course the carpenter that worked on these things,
mm-hmm.
they had an interest in keeping them in good shape, in good condition that whole time, thinking that maybe someday we're going to, you know, run these again, or there's another plan for these maybe.
Yeah, especially because they're such unique craft, you know.
Yeah.
They're handmade. We should talk a little bit about the specs. I know you mentioned the beam and the fact that they were building these watercraft specifically for this track, right?
Yeah, because they're very, very small. Again, 10 feet, 5 inches long.
I already have some questions regarding performance and equality, because, you know, the thing about racing is that ideally the rules make it such that whether we're talking about a car, a truck, or even in this case, a speedboat, they're supposed to all be very close in performance. Mm-hmm. But some of the engines were different on these. And then, you know, the material was different in a couple with the fiberglass. So like these engines might be 44 cubic inch inboard Crossley engines or 48 cubic inch.
Well, the difference is the 44 was a tin block.
Yeah.
And the 48 cubic inch was a
cast iron.
Yeah, an iron block. And it was more reliable. I guess the tin block was unreliable and they, not quickly, but they decided, well, we're going to start swapping some of these out. And I think that's what they did. So, I don't know if they all eventually shifted over to 48 or if they had a mix of the two, but they also had different classes. Now, I saw somewhere that this was actually an American Powerboat Association or APBA sanctioned event. So they ran under APBA official rules. And I think that, you know, their class designation, I don't know if it was because of the fiberglass hull or because of the wooden hull or if it was because of the engine size or what it was, but they had different classes. So, races would be, you know, anywhere between 8 or 10 laps in length, depending on the class that you were in.
Right.
The APBA class. So, this whole thing is really fascinating. I mean, there's so much about it, like, and it was so temporary. It only ran again for that one season in 1950.
Yeah.
Starting in, and I've got the, I guess the opening poster or bill that was posted.
Yeah,
this
is so cool.
It really is. I got a printout in front of me, and in a big, you know, bold red letters, it says speedboat races on the Danbury Fair Water Course, the first water speedway of its kind in the United States. An opening night, Saturday, May 20th, 1950, and then every Saturday night thereafter. So, you know, the grandstands, for instance, would open at 7 p.m. The time trials would begin at 7:30, and then the races would start at 8:30. And there were seven events, you know, over the course of the evening, and they would have, you know, nationally known pilots. They had, of course, these specially built race boats. They were really fast. They were thrilling, I guess, from what I've heard. Just really an interesting thing. And I was wondering how rough do you think that water would be after one lap around this thing? It's got to be. I mean,
right?
The you know, just the action of the wakes, you know, going back and forth between those tiled walls.
And you can get a feel for that in some of the pictures of the races, because there are pictures available online.
Very few,
a handful. One thing I forgot to mention that I'm sure you guys are dying to hear, how fast did these go? They went in excess of 40 miles an hour, which may not sound like that much, but when you consider the tight quarters and you consider the tiny, the tiny size of these boats, that's pretty fast.
Yeah, these single-seater boats that you're right on the water. And, you know, the guys that own them now, they say, you know, I've pushed this one up to 50 miles an hour on the lake before. But he said, when you're going 35, it feels like you're going 60. When you're going, you know, 45, it feels like you're going 100 miles an hour. It's just, it's an unbelievable sensation of speed when you're that low and in such a small, loud craft. Mm-hmm. And that's what they say, is it's a lot like go-karts on the water. You know, in that same sense, you know, it's very agile. It's not very smooth at all. It's a rough ride. It's abrupt. It's loud. It's just a lot of fun. There's so much sensation, to these boats that, again, you don't have to go, you know, faster than 40 miles an hour to feel like you're really, really traveling fast. And of course, when you get into that tight, you know, the confines of that tight course.
Yeah.
And with other boats all around you, I can't imagine what that was like. And some of these photos, you know, I see at the most, any photo that I can find is four boats together.
Right, yeah.
But there are shots of it, of these boats at the launching dock.
Right, as the pilots are prepping.
Yeah, and they're kind of holding them back, getting ready to start the boats, and we'll tell you about that in a second too. But they're holding the boats back, and there's more than four in a row there, so, there's a chance that there were as many as six or seven on the course at one time.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention this yet, Ben, but these boats don't have any gears.
So, oh yeah, no clutch.
Yeah, there's no clutch in these. So
they just go.
Yeah, so you know, you're waiting at the dock to start. They power it up and that's it. That's the start of the race.
It's
off and on, and that's about it. Of course, you got throttle control.
Right.
You know, for speed variation, but there's no neutral, there's no reverse, there's you just on or off, and that's it.
And these are time trials. Oh, and one thing, I want to take a quick side note here. Listeners, several of you probably caught this earlier. we said that originally this fair ran for 10 days every October, but then we said the Danbury Water Racing ran for a season, which was every Saturday starting in May that year. And that is because the fair expanded. And
yeah.
We should point that out.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, when they're running the midget cars or the stock cars,
that's
the same thing. You know, you go to the fairgrounds in order to watch the races on Saturday.
Right,
and
yeah.
It's just the local track, really, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fair is not operational, but the track is.
And we have to ask, Scott, what happened? You know, because they put these boats in dry storage for, what, 3 decades? But it's not like they were stowed away and forgotten, because employees for the fair were still taking these out, performing regular maintenance, turning over the engine and stuff.
I find that incredible.
You know,
I mean, we said earlier that they had an interest in keeping them in good shape. And
yeah.
I find that amazing that they would, you know, have employees oil the machines, maintain them so that, you know, they were in relatively good shape. I don't know if they were even, you know, water worthy at that, you know, after 30 years, probably not. And seals dry out and things like that. But,
sure.
But mechanically they were sound. And so I guess what happened was they realized that, you know, it just wasn't the moneymaker that they thought it was going to be. And it was probably very difficult to keep the water in the track. You know, they probably were just continually battling that.
Yeah.
That situation. So, I think they just decided that it was a better fit for them to, you know, go with the car racing again for the 1951 season, which is what they did. They removed the aquaway, you know, all the walls and all that, and they put down a paved course. This time they made it a little bit bigger. I think they went to a third of a mile and a paved course, a paved oval, and then resumed stock car and midget car racing. And they did that for decades again.
It's just, if we can imagine, you know, the logistics involved, to your point, are probably what sank the race. You know, just having to continually support that sort of infrastructure.
Oh, I'm sure it did. Yeah, it can't be easy. It's got to be a pretty big drag on the staff there. You know, to have to, and I don't mean a drag as far as like it's a task they don't want to do. I mean, it's like it takes a lot of man hours to do something like that, to put something like that together, and then to maintain the track and to maintain the machines and. Because you know these boats are there. It's part of the property. It's part of the whole thing. I mean, the whole show is run right there from the fairgrounds. It's like all under that umbrella. I'm over describing this. I think because it makes sense. It's like instead of having people bring in their own individual race cars to race in the track, they've got these vehicles that stay there at the track, and of course you know they have teams that come in and race them, but they're the property of the fair.
And now for a interesting question, or at least I think it's interesting. Listeners, I hope it interests you as well. Scott, this question is for you and for everybody out there listening. Will you race in one of these?
Would I race in one?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I think, especially in comparison to several other types of races that were around this time, stock cars, midgets, etc., it's strange. I know it only ran for one season, so we don't have a good sample size, but it seems somewhat safer.
Yeah. We didn't hear of any, you know, tragedies happening at this fair or anything.
Right.
Like
so
that.
This wasn't something that got shut down due to a catastrophe or an accident.
No, it wasn't like the boats were launching themselves into the crowd or something. You know, it wasn't like that.
It's just that the fans seemed, the fan base for stock cars and the profit margin for stock cars seem more consistent and reliable.
Yeah, that's probably it. I'm sure there was a lot of interest in this, and I'm sure they had a regular crowd that came.
Sure.
But I don't think that it was quite the draw, as you say, for the stock cars and the midget racing.
But you would race, and I would race as well.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever rented a small boat like this? I've done this at resort locations before.
Uh-huh.
At like, let's see, Silver Lake, Michigan, where the sand dunes are out on the west side of the state. They used to. I don't know if they still do or not, but they rent little boats like this, single-seaters. Maybe it's 2-seat. I can't remember, but very small. And what's great about it is that, you know, they're not like tethered to a track. You know, you don't have to remain in one simple little area. You got access to the whole lake. You can go anywhere you want. If you get a couple people that rent them, you can do some wake jumping with, you know, the other boats.
That's cool. Yeah.
And they're fast. It's not like they're, you know, like powered with electric motors or anything. They've got a pretty fast outboard motor on them. And there's a few places around, at least around in the States, that you can still do this kind of thing. I don't know if Silver Lake still does it or not, but because that was, you know, 25 years ago, maybe even more. But man, it's a lot of fun. It's so much fun. I had an uncle that would race boats like this, semi-professionally, I guess probably in the APVA, on Lake Orion in Michigan. And, he and his kid, he was an engineer at General Motors. He had a blast doing this type of thing. He talked about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Had trophies, had, photos of, the small little, Seafleet type boats that, they put these enormous outboard motors on and, just have a blast. I don't know how fast they would go, but it was really fun.
I have not had the pleasure yet. It's officially on my bucket list. When I was much younger, there was a thing that some amusement parks would do where they would let kids and adults rent in kind of an enclosed space watercraft that were essentially like tiny bumper cars.
Oh, yeah.
You remember those?
Yeah, sure. I think there's still some places around that do that. Bumper boats, I think is what
they
call it.
Yeah. So I had that experience, which I think is totally different. One time I got in an escapade on a jet ski that did not belong to me. I think the statute of limitations has passed. These were back in high school days.
Was this a stand-up jet ski, or was it one that you sit on?
Oh, it was all classy, man. It was you sit on it, and you have the you have to tie the key to your wrist, mm-hmm. so that if you don't fall off. I fell off several times in the course of stealing this vehicle.
I think that's stealing the vehicle. I see.
It's borrowing if you give it back at the end.
I see. I was thinking if it was long enough ago, it would be the original, the official jet ski, the Kawasaki, I think.
Yeah. No,
the stand-up ones. Those are a lot of fun too.
Those are cool.
Yeah, they're really tough to handle the first time you try it, but. They're fun. Those personal watercraft are a blast. And this is kind of like, it's a version of, I guess it is a personal watercraft, but it's a different type of personal watercraft. You'd have to see the photos to understand the type of boat we're talking about. And Ben, before we get too much farther, because I want to talk about what happened to the boats eventually.
But
the owner of the fair that we didn't get to mention.
Oh, Leahy.
John Leahy. He owned the fair from the 1940s until he died in 1975, and he left behind. And I know this because I found some official court documents later, from 1991, but he left behind an estate that was valued at $7,213,604. So he did all right with the fair, over those years. And I think that there was a lot more to it than that, because I saw documents that had numbers in the $25 million range when the family sold off their interest in the fair.
Wow.
Which was a little bit later, but I guess once he died in 1975, the whole organization just kind of fell into disarray. And the last day of the fair was October 12th of 1981. And they say in 1981, 400,000 people attended the fair that year. So it was still very popular. Mm-hmm. But the organization itself was crumbling because the guy that was at the top was really keeping everything together. He was no longer there, and it just sort of crumbled from the top down. And it's sad. I mean, it's really sad. And then eventually, the fair in 1981, so just maybe, 6 years later?
Yeah.
6 or 7 years later, they decided they were not going to hold the fair anymore. They shut it down, which was a very sad day for a lot of people. And they erected a mall, I think, on that location.
Right.
There's the Danbury Fair Mall, which I don't know, Ben. That's terrible. That there's a shopping mall now on the property that was this what they thought was going to be called the Danbury Pleasure Park. Back in the 1860s.
Yeah.
But it was the site of a very famous and by all accounts, a lot of fun state fair for many years.
Yeah, it's iconic. One of the other things that you might hear of, especially the folks who are familiar with this, those of us out in the Danbury or Connecticut area, Scott, we have to mention that another thing that made this fair so famous were these gigantic statues of Paul Bunyan and Uncle Sam. There were more than just those. Those are two of the big ones. But they're like 38 feet tall, that at least Uncle Sam was. And when the fair was closed down, a lot of these were purchased by, local businesses and continued on.
Yeah, right? like Uncle Sam went to the Magic Forest in Lake George, New York. And I think the other one, the Paul Bunyan statue, which is there's more to the Paul Bunyan story, but the Paul Bunyan, eventually, this is a weird twist on this. The one from the fair was painted like a hippie and then moved to the Max Yeager's farm where they held the Woodstock, music festival back in 1969.
Uh-huh.
So That one has kind of a strange history to it, but the Paul Bunyan figure itself was mass produced by the company. So there's more than one of this Paul Bunyan figure out there in the world somewhere. I don't know how many of them they made, but they sold these identical sculptures to tire shops and muffler shops. And so sometimes when you see this Paul Bunyan character, it's actually the muffler man. So I think a lot of people can picture what the muffler man looks like,
right,
because
yeah.
they have that the giant statue of what in some cases was Paul Bunyan, in some cases is the muffler man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so interesting. It's funny to find out where these things end up.
Right. And this is something that we have seen before happen to things that are considered Americana or pieces of American history. Maybe the property values in a place go up. That's what happened in Western Connecticut. And you see a lot of bigger businesses moving in, which, you know, it has its pros and its cons.
Well,
because
sure. I mean,
it's good for the economy when that stuff happens, but then also, you know, you're losing a piece of history.
Well, yeah, that's what I meant by, you know, it's kind of sad to hear that, you know, a mall moved in there. It's just, I guess the nostalgia part of the whole
thing.
You know, there was a site of this, this really fun fair, and a lot of people have some, you know, great family memories there, and now it's a shopping mall. That's all I meant. I didn't mean that, you know, it's bad for the local economy or anything like that. I wasn't trying to get any political stance
or
anything like that. I just mean that, you know, a lot of people have some really good memories, and you'll hear some, you know, great stories that people tell online about, you know, going to the Danbury Fair and, you know, I met my wife there or, you know, stuff like that.
I feel bittersweet about it because there's an article from 1981 in the Times, in the New York Times, that talks about the last hurrah of the fair mm-hmm. in October 4th.
What, the final 10 days?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it reads almost like an obituary,
yeah.
you know, but that is not the end of the story for the Danbury Racers. As a matter of fact, we have a little bit of a potential mystery.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, 1981 was the last year of the fair, and they knew that they were going to have to get rid of a bunch of their assets. I mean, everything, you know,
right.
all the rides and
the statues, the buildings,
whatever they could get rid of, right?
The boats as well.
So the boats, yeah, the boats are in storage, in dry storage. And they all went up for auction, or at least 19 of the boats went up for auction. So, again, this is already a mystery, because if there were 21 to 29 of these, as we have heard,
mm-hmm.
Why did only 19 of them go up for auction? Maybe at that time that's all that were there. That could be the case.
Yeah.
But we do know that of the 19, 9 of them were sold at auction for $2,500 each. So they all went for kind of a flat price per boat of $2,500 to different people. It wasn't mm-hmm. like one person bought all of them. And no one really remembers what happened to the other 10 boats. They don't know if they were eventually sold. They were just destroyed. They don't know if, you know, somebody just carted them away after the auction.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows what happened to the other 10. You know, and that's not saying what happened to the other 9 that weren't in the original auction or 10 that weren't in the original auction. So already a mystery there. And we said that, you know, there are 4 that are known to be seaworthy today, as far as they know anyways. You know, these people that got them together the last time, I think it was a group called the Bay State Woodies. And that is the Massachusetts chapter of the Antique and Classic Boat Society, or ACBS.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look up some information on their site if you want to find out, you know, what happened on that day, or, you know, what, you know, the occurrence, I guess the bringing together of the original Danbury Racers, and see,
yeah.
you know, what it was all about on that one day. But, and they'll also give you some hints about, you know, where the other boats are, because I have so many questions here about the number of boats remaining. I thought I had it down to either 9 total or 12 total, but then there's that other, you know, hidden bit of information that says that there might have been 10 that never went to auction. So that kind of throws
right.
a wrench in the whole thing. But I guess there are supposedly 3 in Connecticut, 2 in New Hampshire, and then 4 in Wisconsin. Doesn't mean they're all, you know, seaworthy. It just means that they know that those went there in 1980.
Right.
And they don't know where they are now. I mean, of course, the ones that were brought out this year were from different places. I think one of the owners that came out for the 2010 event was from Connecticut. Another one was from New Hampshire. And then another one, oh, again, a second one from Connecticut. So Two out of the three were from Connecticut on that day and one from New Hampshire. And then they knew of the one in Wisconsin, but the owner of the Wisconsin boat didn't make it to the event. So it's all kind of a mystery to where these are. But I like stories like this, as you know. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at the boats online, if you look at the photos of you just search Danbury Racers, you're going to find, boats that are examples of what all the boats look like, really. They have a distinctive style to them, a distinctive look. So if you ever run across one of these things, at a boatyard somewhere, someone who has antique or wooden boats on the property and don't really know what they have, this would be something interesting. It's a piece of history, really. And I think there's a bunch of them out there, maybe still, that are just undiscovered, or maybe, no one knows what they have. They're just sitting in a garage or a shed, that their grandfather left them.
Right, exactly. That's also something I'm wondering. This is where you come in, ladies and gentlemen. If you have access to or know of someone who has a, unidentified, pretty small-looking boat.
Yeah, single-seater, looks like a race boat.
Yeah.
Could be wood. It's not likely fiberglass.
It's overwhelmingly likely to be wood.
Yeah, because the fiberglass one, the one that showed up to this event, there's one that was fiberglass, number 38.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other one, and I think that one was destroyed. They know that it was a fire maybe or something. Mm-hmm. It was destroyed. So they do know that that one is out of the mix, but the rest of them I think are wooden. And again, they have a very unusual design. You'll be able to spot them immediately if you know what to look for.
Yeah. So, Give it a look. If you have an inkling that there might be something like that, we love to know about it, because these boats are out there somewhere. The odds are also overwhelmingly likely that there are a few people probably in the United States right now who have access to something like this and maybe are not aware.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what, Ben? I just wanted to mention this too.
Yeah.
On the front of this poster that I'm looking at here, uh-huh, for the original season, the first race, really, it has the admission prices. You want to hear what the admission was to get into the Danbury Races for the first race?
For the Danbury Races specifically, yes.
Yeah.
Because the fair was a quarter.
Yeah, the fair was a quarter. This is, it's a little bit more than, I guess, for this. Children under 5 were free, of course. It seems
right.
Like that's
yeah.
Usually the way. Children under 12 years old were 42 cents. Plus 8 cents tax, so it's 50 cents for them to get in.
Curse you, Uncle Sam!
It's funny how they add this, right? And adults, 83 cents with 17 cents tax, so it was a dollar for adults to get in. And then after that, but this is the thing, this is unheard of now. After you pay that admission fee of either 50 cents or a dollar, or free if you're young enough, I guess, there were no other charges. Now you'd have to buy your own food, of course, but by no other charges they mean
free
you got to park for free. There was a free race program that went along with
mm-hmm.
it. Of course, all the entertainment that you could absorb,
yeah,
that's free.
Yeah,
not really. I guess that's what cost you a buck.
Well, it was an all night thing too, because it starts at 7. That's when the doors open, the grandstand opens, and then they do the time trial 7:30. And then after that, that's when the race begins at 8:30.
I wonder if they raced under the lights, or if it was just simply until dark or something like that. Because later in the year,
it would be May.
Yeah, well, this is May, but as they got later in the racing season,
right toward the autumn,
Yeah, they might have had lights. I bet that had a really cool look to it.
And that would have been really cool.
Of course, you're sitting in a state fairgrounds grandstand, so mm-hmm. it's concrete and wood, and probably bench seats if I had to guess. It was probably a really fun evening out.
This landlocked water course is constructed directly in front of the Big Danbury Fair concrete and steel grandstand. The shape of the race course forces the daredevil pilots to drive with the highest degree of skill, creating excellent competitive racing. I love these older ads.
Nice work, Ben.
Oh, hey.
You should do you should have done the radio ads for that, but a little before your time.
It was a bit before my time, yeah.
It's probably before your dad's time, even.
Huh.
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know. 1950, he would have been a youngster.
He listens to this show, and I will not compromise his personal information.
I understand, but you know what? Man, what a time to be in Connecticut, huh? To be able to see something like this.
I would have
loved to have seen something like this. I like stuff like this anyways. I mean, they're mm-hmm. racing of all types, but when it's on a tight circuit like this, it's almost like, as we said earlier, like go-kart racing on water.
Yeah.
It had to have been fun to watch. It just had to have been a really, like a, an action-packed, a thrill-packed race.
And, you know, this also makes me wonder what other current local races are out, not just, you know, like local racetrack races, but what other maybe unorthodox or slightly I don't want to say weird or out there, but, you know, a step away from the mainstream kind of races are out in the U.S. or abroad right now.
We had years ago, we did an Unusual Races podcast, and we dug into races all around the world that were anything but the normal, anything out of the ordinary. And I don't even recall what was in that podcast, but there was a big mix of stuff. I mean, really, really strange stuff like cheese wheel racing.
Yeah, yeah, and, you the know, downhill like, cheese wheel chase.
Yeah, stuff like
which
that.
Which is way more dangerous than it sounds.
I hope we mentioned that in that podcast now that I think about it, because it was, but there's some really interesting, fun things in that podcast. So, and it's old, so, you know, be kind if you listen to it again.
Probably
back in the high-speed stuff days.
Oh, man.
Probably. Yeah. But, there's a lot of really interesting races out there. I'd love for, you know, some fans to write in and tell us about stuff sort of like this, you know, like one-off type stuff that happens around the U.S. that we just don't hear about because, you know, because it's a local thing.
Absolutely. And with that, we are going to head out. I don't know if we're going to get into a speedboat race when we leave the studio, but
I doubt it.
I know, but it's cool to dream.
It is cool to dream. Man, you know, okay. Last thing, and then we'll
Here,
I promise.
But sure.
We did do that podcast a long time ago on, I think it was Can You Build Your Own Boat?
Yeah.
And some of the craft we talked about, in fact, I know the ones that I was, you know, most favorable towards were the small hydroplane type boats like this. Mm. I would still love to build something like this, but I don't really have a place to put it anyways. I mean, like to race it, because there's not a whole lot of lakes down here that are, you know, easily accessible. Not like when I was up in Michigan, they were everywhere, or in Minnesota. It would be so much fun to build and drive something like this, or maybe even find one of the original Danbury racers, huh? I mean, that's like, you know, finding a diamond out in a field somewhere or something. You know, it's a rare, extremely rare find.
Right. It has happened before.
Yeah.
But that's about all you can say about
it. Yeah. I mean, and again, you know, if we get enough listeners that are looking for these types of boats, maybe they'll start turning up. You never know.
Heck, man, while we're talking about local races, you know what this makes me think of is the Soapbox Derby that Atlanta holds at the street right outside of our office. Dude, we could totally do that.
Yeah, we could build the car here and walk it over to the race course. It's that close.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, in terms of driving, and I say this with no disrespect to either of us, you are a more skilled, responsible driver. I am a more skilled daredevil driver, you know, because I do my own stunts.
Well, sure.
So maybe we could, maybe when this is coming up, we could build something, because listeners, ladies and gentlemen out there, you guys probably have some experience and some tips and tricks for us. I'm going to get some more information on this and maybe see if we can follow it up.
This is like the big Red Bull event, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a big deal. I mean, it's coming up. It's got to be coming up soon. It happens end of summer, I think.
Yeah.
Or at least it did last year.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We better get our keisters in gear.
I guess so.
But, I wonder what the prize is. If the prize is just a lot of Red Bull, I don't know if I want to do it.
That's right. Hopefully you get the Red Bull before you race, and that way a little more intense.
It's a big time, though. They closed down the street for it.
So. I did not attend last year, so I'd be interested in seeing what's going on out there.
And so let us know if you have any experience or tips with Soapbox Derbies. And of course, if your primary tip is, guys, don't do it, we will respect your opinion. But I'm getting more and more into the idea of seeing how fast they can go with or without wrecking.
Oh, very well. That's always something to strive for.
We could each build a car and race each other.
We just do that on our own. We don't need any event.
We don't need no stinking events.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Scott, we wouldn't have the street closed down, so that would complicate things.
That's true. Just have to, you know, trust the flagman.
Okay, so now we're looking for a flagman as well. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to check out more episodes about racing, we have some stuff that is right up your alley or square in your lane.
And please, please, please keep your eyes open for these Danbury racers. And if you do see one, tell us. We'd love to know about it.
Yeah.
Well, first, buy it. And then tell us about it, because I'd love to know where the rest of these things ended up.
Mm-hmm. And if you do buy it, because we are serious about this, we will reimburse you gladly. Just send the bill via email to jonathan.strickland@howstuffworks.com.
I'm sure he'll appreciate that.
I'm sure he will. Heart of gold.
Of course. Anything for the cause.
Anything for the cause. Oh, man. We might be in hot water when he hears that one. But if you are already on the computer, you want to hear more about these races, go ahead, check out our previous podcast at our website, carstuffshow.com. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where you can see some of the things that we talk about every week, including stuff like this vintage ad for the Danbury Racers. And most importantly, if you have an idea for an upcoming topic, if you have some feedback, Scott, I don't know. There might be somebody who has some experience having seen this.
Oh, you know, it's entirely possible.
And if you are one of those lucky few, or if you have a story related to a similar event, we'd love to hear it. And maybe your fellow Car Stuff listeners would like to hear it, too. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.